Hello and welcome to the next podcast in our series of NHS Estates podcasts. My name's Lisa Geary and I'm a partner in the real estate healthcare team at DSC Beechcroft. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Andrew Morgan, a partner in our planning team who advises a number of healthcare clients on all aspects of their planning requirements. And today we're going to focus particularly on planning considerations to take into account when healthcare bodies are looking at Health on the High Street projects, which follows on from the webinar we did on this topic in March 2025, so a few months ago. But Andrew's also going to give us a little bit of an update on all the interesting things that are happening in the planning arena in the context of fairly significant imminent legislative change. So a big welcome to Andrew. And I think probably the best way to start is by focusing on these significant changes. Andrew, what can you tell us about those?
Thank you, Lisa. Well, yeah, as you say, this time, when we were doing the webinar for Health on the High Street, we didn't really have any details about what this new government's going to be bringing forward for its first piece of major planning legislation. And so now we have that. Now we have the draft of the Planning Infrastructure Bill, and it's in the House of Lords at the moment. It's come out of the Commons with a number of comments. And we can see immediately that the focus from government's very much about thinking around the subject of, not one particular kind of development that it's trying to drive for, housing and employment and well-being, and obviously social care and infrastructure are always high on the agenda. And all those things are things that this government said they were going to be delivering on in their manifesto. And as what we've heard about the allocation of money through the budget as well. But now this is the first time we're seeing some real breadth to the kinds of ideas. And so, for health clients, this is really, really good news because it means that the government's really focused on all forms of social infrastructure to support that always popular housing agenda of trying to hit this 1.5 million new homes over their parliament. And what comes with that are all the things that, people need every day. And in particular for this session, their health needs. And so when we're talking about what this legislation will be doing to shape new communities, the locations of new communities, what kinds of infrastructure they need to have to support those communities at the scale the government would like to see and at the rate that it would like to see, it means that we also need to be talking about, what is the High Street and what are the opportunities for different sorts of health clients and their projects. So really that's just the context of this. The landscape is really one where we can expect, I think, some quite ambitious change through planning. And so it's really that, looking at those opportunities for our clients.
Thanks, Andrew. That's really interesting. In that context then, thinking about high street use classes, how actually have the changes in those use classes increased flexibility, and in particular, how have they become more flexible for health?
In a big way, I suppose it doesn't feel very recent now, but September 2020 was the kind of the line in the sand when the then government, they recast, all of the typical use classes that we're used to seeing on any given high street. We're thinking retail of goods, retail of services, finance. A classes were the retail classes to that 2020 point. And then things like employment as well, office space, we're thinking to that point B use classes. Now, and as I say, it's not new, but I suppose it might be really important for health clients who are looking at new opportunities, thinking how they seek consents. Are they going to work with potentially existing consents? And so it's very important to have an understanding of how flexibility could work in their favour, and whether it would be better to take a, you know, pursue a brand new permission for something, or whether it might be that there's an opportunity in an existing property with a consent, and then understanding how you make that work for you and whether it can. So I think there is flexibility. When I say E in my mind now pretty much stands for E for almost everything on the high street. There are some small retail exceptions and other uses that fall outside of that. But it means that all health facilities, health centres, clinics, they all are high street health uses that can now move within that Class E. So if you're looking at something that is a food retail or retail for goods, an E-class permission doesn't therefore mean that you can automatically just kind of move in if you're taking the space that was previously occupied by a high street retailer. But in planning use terms, it means that there's not going to be a material change of use. That's the key here. It's not to say that you can obviously do whatever fit out and shopfront works you may need to take that space and operate. But it is about knowing that you're not going to have an issue with the principle of the planning use. That's the key.
Thanks, Andrew. No, that's really helpful, isn't it? And if you think about how innovative and creative we're going to need to be with health spaces moving forward, and particularly in view of the 10-year plan that's come out and looking at neighbourhood centres and integrating community care with primary care and looking at prevention, then all this flexibility is actually heading in the right direction. But as you say, still needs some careful thought. So if you are dealing with a property with an existing pre-Class E planning permission, what should you be aware of in particular?
Well, I think the first thing is making sure that the description of development works for you, as well as all the other conditions and bolt-ons that came with that consent. Because if you're talking in kind of pre-E, your kind of old money A's and B's and C's classes, then you are operating within a framework that only allows a certain degree of flexibility. And it was usually between A classes and between B classes in high street terms. There wasn't this ability to move quite so easily. And so that old movement, pre-Class E, was dealt with under a previous version of the permitted development order, the general permitted development order, and the effect of the new Class E legislation is that where you have permissions that were granted, say, up to 2020, and they were given old planning prefixes for use classes, the high street use classes, then you still only had the flexibility to move in the old way. So it's not as flexible, and obviously it's a very broad concept of not being as flexible, but strong recommendation to clients who are looking to take spaces in existing properties with existing permissions to do their due diligence, be it planning consultancy, planning lawyers, to look carefully at whether the proposals can actually shift between the permitted uses under old permitted development rules. And as well as I mentioned conditions and everything else that's attached to permission, it's crucial to look at things that would otherwise be a potential limit, either in ability to operate the client's proposed use. So if we have conditions attached which are very much speaking to what was the original proposal as it would have been physically delivered when the consent was first issued, and that would have been a different sort of high street use, then it's about whether a health use can work within those confines, thinking floor space requirements, thinking opening hours, and then as well as what is an existing permission subject to in terms of potential compliance with other development control mechanisms, such as Section 106. Because if you're taking space in an existing scheme, then it could be, if let's say we're taking space in a some ground floor commercial of a new garden village or an urban extension as a form of new high street, then those sorts of planning permissions are typically subject to planning obligations that require sustainable forms of transport. And so employees of those spaces would need to adhere potentially with things like travel planning. So when you're taking, you know, stepping into a planning situation, it really is important to do your diligence just to ensure exactly what you're in for, as well as making sure that, you know, you're not going to have to go and obtain another planning permission or perhaps vary the one you've got.
Thanks, Andrew. So just picking up on one of those points, if, for example, a planning condition imposed a restriction on hours of operation, which isn't uncommon, and that actually didn't work for your proposed use, how could you go about amending that to make the existing consent relevant and helpful and useful to you?
Well, there are a number of options open. It depends really about the materiality of what it is you're looking to change. So hours of operation, obviously the context is really important. And so if you're talking about the hours of operation of a business that might need to be serviced by vehicles at early and late hours, if it's an ambulance service, I've advised health clients on issues to deal with traffic associated with health development, like ambulances, with flashing lights and noise and needing to agree specific arrangements with local authorities. So the context here is really important for the health user. So hours of operation, again, it may be that that's considered to be a non-material change, because if you're tweaking the start or the end of an authorized period of use every day, or perhaps extending a use into weekend operation, which wasn't something that was envisaged, it's really about engaging the local authority to kind of contextualize what you're doing, so that they can give some thought to how material it is to then help you work with the best and ideally the lightest touch and quickest route to making the change. I mentioned minor non-material. I mean, that's an application under Science Bit, Section 96A of the Town and Country Planning Act 1990. That is the first kind of go-to for the way in which you amend a permission, amending the permission, keeping the permission that you've got, but it continuing as amended, as opposed to generating a new permission. And what is material is very much down to the local authority. So it's really for the clients to help the authority understand and find the correct approach, not just for expediency, but also to make sure that the approach to how you get to your varied permission is procedurally and legally robust, because at the end of the day, clients need to be able to rely upon consents to know that they can confidently operate and open the doors so that there's no risk of challenge. And it's not just because the local authority agree with you that therefore that's de-risked. Obviously, the public have scrutiny over these decisions as well. Section 73 of the Town and Country Plan 1990 is technically an application for planning permission, which is subject to conditions that are different to those that were originally applied. And so that's not about the change that you're making needing to be non-material. And so let's say you propose a change in our example of hours of operation, the context and the neighboring uses, perhaps it's in a close to residential area, the hours of operation are actually considered from an amenity perspective to be quite significant. And so it may be the local authority says, we need to go down, we can't go down the non-material route, but we will entertain going down the Section 73 route. And that comes with a proportionate amount of consultation. One really important note for clients is that it's not possible to amend a description of development under Section 73. It's only possible to amend the conditions of a planning permission under Section 73. And that also goes for the conditions of all conditions of a planning permission, be they the conditions on an outline grant of planning or also the conditions on a reserved matters approval. So if there are aspects of a description of development that, having taken advice, you also need to change to make sure that the proposal is consistent with what you're going to be doing, it may be that you need to combine sometimes a Section 73 application with a non-material amendment to the description of development, because a non-material amendment can change any aspect of a planning permission. So all those things are available. Ideally, planning permissions have some degree of flexibility built into their drafting anyway. That there's a bit of discouragement of conditioning of planning permissions, but then keeping the door open to have a conversation with the local authority to then change basically everything. So what are called tailpieces on conditions are frowned on. By that, I mean adding unless otherwise agreed to everything. And then it becomes rather murky for the public to understand, well, exactly what this permission is for. And so sometimes those things are available. It really depends upon the subject matter and how material those things are. It's unlikely that something that was considered fundamental to the permission will be open to that sort of unless otherwise agreed mechanism. But I do think, having just talked about hours of operation, in my experience, those are the sorts of things where it may be that an exchange of correspondence pursuant to that kind of flexible wording, could well be attached to things like hours of operation. So again, I think keeping options open, working with the local authority, but fundamentally making sure that somebody's run a rule over the permission to make sure it works for you.
Thank you. I mean, what I'm hearing really is it's needs a lot of thought. It needs a lot of sort of collaborative discussions, I think, with all the stakeholders, and also obviously taking expert advice on how to sort of work through the minefield of the legislation. But also there's quite a bit of strategy involved, I think, in getting the best outcome.
Indeed. Thanks, indeed. Andrew. Indeed. Yes. I think, and just to say, I mean, working collaboratively, I think it's really important to say that I on projects, we often work with quite a broad team of consultants, from planning consultants through to architects, through to project managers. And that collaboration and making sure that the diligence work and the recommendations are worked up by everyone in unison, because these sorts of, if you do have a permission that you need to have a dialogue with a local authority on, everyone on the client side obviously needs to be completely au fait with the rationale for what we're doing, and support the procedural approach, just to make sure everything happens as smoothly and as quickly as possible. So collaborative working is super important.
Great. I mean, with that in mind, I know that you deal with a number of large residential-led mixed-use schemes, which often include requirements for health provision as part of new high streets or local centres. So over and above, obviously, some of the really helpful insights you've already given us, what are your thoughts on how to make those opportunities a success?
Early engagement is the key. I was just having a conversation today with a lawyer at another private law firm acting externally for a local authority. And this is in the context of a Section 106 negotiation, which is an agreement which contains all of the obligations and restrictions on the development being brought forward in this case. Residential-led, large, mixed-use scheme, including a local centre with a variety of those E-class uses to form a brand new hub, a community hub, to support that new housing scheme. And so it came up today that there was a question really about what is the specification going to be to fit out this new health space? Because in planning terms, the developer knows the amount of floor space that it needs to provide, because that was something that was prescribed by an infrastructure delivery policy in planning. And so therefore, you know what you're applying for. But the really big missing piece of for the developers is how early can you engage with the ultimate healthcare bodies and the primary care providers in order to know what they want? Because if you don't know what shell and core of a space means, if you're not au fait with the three stages of NHS fit out, to know how to then assign cost to those things, to have a negotiation with the local planning authority and to be seen to be working with the health provider, then it means that there are many question marks. And so you're kind of missing a trick as the health provider from being the recipient of something that is going to better match your needs, and better match your needs without having to invest too much public money. Because there was sometimes a negotiation to be had about the delivery of the space, and as I say, to what specification it is to be handed over in. Also, the negotiations of the leases for the occupation of the space and how favourable those leases are. if you come in early, and there's therefore a huge benefit to the developer to be aligned with the ultimate occupier and operator of the space, it just makes that conversation with the local planning authority about giving credibility to what you're doing, because they can see the parties working together to deliver the outcome. And so I suppose it's really to find a way, particularly on these schemes that involve new larger communities and therefore have significant critical mass to their commercial space and their high street space, to find ways of identifying the contacts within local planning authorities and to facilitate those conversations with developers, all the other way around. It's obviously it's for the clients to decide upon how they wish to engage, because often consultation on planning permissions is something that can be quite patchy in terms of being a consultee on an application and giving a fairly, say, generic response to something where you would support the development, but recognizing that it will generate the need for additional healthcare floor space. And I'm often privy to the healthcare consultee responses that come back, and there's a well-trodden methodology for working out what financial contributions are linked to the increase in development arising from a planning permission. And sometimes it doesn't really go beyond that for quite a period of time, because there is a request for a financial contribution for the healthcare or the primary healthcare body to be able to invest in existing and or new infrastructure to serve the development. But there's a disconnect between that request and receiving that money, and then how healthcare needs might be better met in the context of the development to actually have that negotiation around the fit out and the occupational documents. So no silver bullet to this, but I think it's for perhaps health clients to try to identify in their areas how they might be better notified and follow up these opportunities to speak to local planning authorities and developers.
Thank you. And then finally, I think to wrap up, Andrew, are there any other top tips or things to be aware of for people who are developing property in the health sector at the moment?
Well, it's a very good, I suppose it's a cautionary tale, but it's certainly kind of a hot topic across the board with a number of my developer clients, health clients included. And it's the case of greenfields. It's an Isle of Wight matter, but the decision that we're concerned with is the Court of Appeal. And it found that a local planning authority had failed to publish a Section 106 agreement sufficiently to give notice to the public of what obligations. I mentioned Section 106 agreements being containing the obligations that developers need to adhere to and ways of controlling the development to make it acceptable. So that document is really critical. And these are documents where it's not just obviously in commercial development that 106 agreements arise. Significant health developments also come with these sorts of requirements of the local authority to make health development acceptable in its context in particular. So we're talking about conditioning of health planning permissions, but also negotiation of 106 agreements. And this case highlights the need that for all developers pursuing planning permission of whatever kind, you need to make sure that your local planning authority undertakes sufficient publicity of the final form of the Section 106 agreement. Otherwise, it could fall foul of this. I suppose it's a refresher on the requirements of the Development Management Procedure Order, which include a regulation that makes it necessary to publish these documents. And it's one of these things that people can often overlook and forget. Everyone's obviously so focused on just being able to secure the planning permission that once all the hard work of negotiating these often quite complex agreements is over, everyone's kind of chomping at the bit to get their planning permission. That's perfectly understandable. But I think now there is a very, very good lesson given by this case to make sure that 106 is published, there is then a sufficient period before the release of a planning permission. So I think that's the top tip at the moment for anybody who's mid or close to finalising their 106 for a health scheme.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's a really helpful note to end on, and something that's obviously very current and a recent decision. So thank you for joining us and for your helpful insights into looking at anything planning related that is relevant to bodies developing healthcare properties, particularly in the context of health on the high street. And thank you for everybody for listening to us, and look out for the next one in our series of NHS Estates podcasts. Thank you.